This week on Emerge, I'm excited to host a conversation with my friend and mentor, Vincent Horn. Vince is the creator of the Buddhist Geeks podcast and one of the people who has most influenced who I have become. It was through the Buddhist Geeks podcast that I first fell in love with podcasts and contemplative practice. And so it's a real treat to share this conversation with you. In this conversation, we asked the question, what wants to emerge now? And let it take us where it wanted us to go. We cover topics like the relationship between the psychological and the political, Trump's superpower, and the personal responsibility we all have in the age of the attention economy. Next week, we will begin a special event that I've been jokingly referring to as the Emerge version of Shark Week, where I'll be featuring three episodes in one week of dialogues with Bonita Roy about her unique and powerful source code analysis process. In this three-episode arc, we will deconstruct and reconstruct the concepts of power, trust, and cooperation. And after that, I'll be taking a couple weeks off of Emerge. The good news is the show has been growing quite quickly in the last couple of months, and I'm very happy about that. And I'm now feeling keen on spending a little bit of time sensing into what opportunities there are to create new forms that serve this emerging network. Finally, if you are receiving value from this project, I invite you to become a supporter of the show by going to anchor.fm/emerge. And if you aren't receiving value from the show, then why are you listening to me drone on? There are many other ways to spend your time. On that note, I'd like to thank the following folks for supporting the podcast: Michael Fogelman, Jared Janes, Diane Leroy, Dennis Wittrock, Chris Holly, Ali Shanti, and Laurel Carrington. Thank you so much for supporting this show. It really does mean the world to me. Okay. That's all for this week. Please enjoy this episode of Emerge with Vincent Horn.
Well, this is all relating to the topic or the question of emergence. Mm-hmm. Something I've been thinking about, and one of the questions that this friend and mentor named Dave Gold brought to my attention is the question, what wants to emerge? And, you know, I work with inquiry meditation. It's like part of my core palette of practices, and so working with questions that don't have answers is like a, you know, fun. And that one feels very, it just feels relevant to the period of time we're in, and like the way that information networks seem to be structured, and the way that systems, complex systems, show these emergent properties that can't be predicted when you look at the components in the networks. Right. You know, that these things emerge out of complex happenings, and that emergence is, you know, it's like, how does that happen? What would that, and what does that look like in the context of, say, meditation or of political action, or I don't know, any number of things.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking a lot about it in terms of like spiritual practice.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a teacher and having students and kind of trying to figure out what that even means.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the first things that comes into my mind is the way that emergence, or what wants to emerge, there's a kind of like sudden change that often, I think, in retrospect looks inevitable once you can see the patterns that led up to it. Like, I think of the way that people think about Trump, where it's like nobody expected it to happen, but then now we have so many good theories about why it happened. And it's like, I don't know, there's a, it's like what wants to emerge to me asks us to look at what, you like, I'm curious about, like, how do you sense into that question, especially beyond your body? You like, and you mentioned networks. It's like we're participating in networks. There's things that want to emerge through networks. Like, what is it like to tune into that? Like, there's so many dimensions of that mm-hmm. question that are appropriate, I think, for where we're at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been increasingly coming to this, like, a new conclusion about just how much more social humans are. It's like the myth of individualism kind of just washing away and seeing, like, oh, no, there's a lot of ways in which we're really socially conditioned. You know, and we behave in ways that are so much about each other.
Yeah.
We even take on each other's vocalizations and tics after hanging out with each other for a short period of time. I notice that it consistently happens.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you take on, you know, even phrases or catchphrases and things. And it's like, you know, people start to share the same kinds of memes
start to look like your dog,
right? You start to look like each other and dress like each other, and there's the way in which you become more like each other,
right?
That nature of identity that's so social, so like the socially constantly being constructed by each other,
you're right. Right,
and of course that intersects with biology and the deep roots of our DNA,
right?
But you know, that's something I've been thinking about a lot, and in the context of meditation, you know, where most of my energy's at, it's like doing social meditation practices.
Yeah.
You know, not just saying what wants to emerge and talking about it, but also what wants to emerge, and then someone responds.
Hmm.
And then what wants to emerge, you know, like grouping, you know, social inquiries,
mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. It seems to add another dimension to it.
Yeah, and when you were saying that, oh man, I mean, I already brought up Trump for some reason. He's now factoring in my mind, you know? And it's like, there's a way in which...
Trump you.
Yeah. Well, there's a way in which, you know, you mentioned this idea of like the individuated separate self of this. And that's a kind of like mythic construction that I think many of us...
Of like the Western Enlightenment.
Yeah, yeah. Like it didn't always was not always the case in human history that there was this idea of an individual self. You know, like
and certainly we had a whole culture of people who think they're individuals
and like reifying it. Yeah, I mean, I remember that I took a class on like Indian religion in college, and the teacher said like that to basically like there's no, like, there are cultures in which there is no individual self, and it was like inconceivable to me at the time, you know, because I was so identified with myself.
With your self-concept.
Well, with my self-concept, exactly, with this idea. And I couldn't conceive of some other way of seeing.
Yeah, right, right. Wasn't a possibility.
It wasn't a possibility in the way I saw the world. And that actually what I think, I'm sensing the same thing as I think you are. And I would even go so far as to say, like, we may be able to be rational, at times and in mm-hmm. certain spaces,
mm-hmm.
but actually we can only really be rational after we've had the social aspect of ourselves kind of satisfied or honored.
Yeah.
Right?
That rings true to me.
Yeah. And so like, what is it like to then look at things like Trump and the phenomenon and the, you know, we can go back and make theories about why it happened. But I think it's interesting to me to look at it like as a strictly social phenomenon, not in terms of policy, not in terms of economic anxiety,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of like what economic anxiety does to our feelings of belonging and mm. being valid and that kind of thing. And
yeah, what happens when generations of people have made their living in a certain way, and then their sons no longer can make a living doing that same thing that their fathers and grandfathers and maybe even great grandfathers did, and who actually made like good salaries and could like afford houses and cars and things that people expected for the middle class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and considering that light, I feel like even as you describe it, and I think you probably, given where you live and the networks you're a part of, have more direct exposure to like the reality of that in some ways?
I'm just starting to, having moved to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, so it's, in the southeast, and it's a pretty mixed community. It's like maybe 50% white, 37% black, and then Hispanic and some other things mixed in. And it's, interesting having been in, Asheville and then Boulder before, which are much more progressive and white communities. You know, I grew up in a mixed family with a Palestinian grandfather who's like my dad,
yeah,
and a lot of Arab relatives and, you know, Orthodox Muslim, you know, aunties praying in the back room and stuff. So I had that experience of being in a mixed community and culture, but also grew up in a very white,
yeah,
Baptist, you know, community. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely saw, you know, the underbelly, the racist underbelly of, you know, America. And it was like, you know, and it was, you know, a part of the culture, like embedded in the culture, like of rural North Carolina, Western North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably true in a lot of other places, red states or red areas of the country.
Yeah.
And there's such a, you know, it's like I think about my own story and how it reflects maybe broader cultural trends, and I think about how I so wanted to get out of there. Mm. You know, it was such like I just knew it was so redneck and backwoods and, you know, all of these things that I would describe it as. You know, and anyone with any intelligence would leave, you know, and go to college and go to a city. Mm-hmm. And that was the route. You know, I got out of there as quickly as possible, went to Raleigh, North Carolina, and then eventually to Boulder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are like cities of incredible privilege and amazing communities of like-minded people getting together and studying and exploring really crazy stuff. And I found my home there, like my spiritual home, but also found like a kind of disconnecting from that some of those differences and like the realities of them. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm trying to like re-engage with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's... I think a lot of people have had that experience of, you know, when you find your like-minded community, but what that also means is you isolate yourself from other communities that are different, you know, and then in those like-minded communities of, you know, many white like-minded communities that are progressive, you know, people start then, you know, just like constantly talking about diversity, and I've been in those communities, and it gets really weird quickly, because it's like, wait a second, there's some gap between what we're talking about and how we're walking our walk. So that's part of what drove me to move, and I just was kind of tired of doing that myself.
Yeah, and it sounds like even as you were speaking about like your encounters with, I think you said the racist underbelly of American culture,
it's like, that's real.
Yeah, I don't have that experience.
That's right? Great. It's well, nice to not have that.
Well, no, not. I mean, that's. I don't think it's either good or bad, but just like that I don't have access to that kind of the knowledge that comes with having that direct experience.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my good friend Marlon, who was one of the few black kids in our school, you know, like two or three. Mm. It's a small school, but still like tiny minority. And I remember just the amount of shit that he got, the number of, you know, kind of more hit kids that would drop the N-word on him in school, and the way that the school didn't really, you know, go out of its way to protect him. It wasn't, you know, it was treated like anything else, but he was, you know, constantly bullied. And I remember walking down the street with him and a cop stopping us. I'd never been stopped by the cops before. And I was like, that was weird. You know, things like that where it's just so obvious. It's if you pay attention.
Totally. Yeah, and what coming to mind now is like there was a way in which I think that we were as a culture or as a nation kind of under the illusion that we had sort of like solved racism, I think, especially after the election of Obama.
Integration,
Well, and even as far back as like the civil rights movement, and it's like it's again revealing to us, I think, the primacy of like the social and the individual, you know, like the psychological, because we had solved it structurally in a way, but we hadn't yet actually addressed it at the level that it was stored, you know, like holographically in the minds of the participants in our culture. And so
A lot of that gets passed on through through family
in really subtle ways. Totally. Yeah, that they're not probably even self-conscious, you know, like we don't learn because we from our parents because they tell us.
People that have these, I mean, and I say people because, you know, I've had them too, and I've seen them come up and worked with them, and I'm sure they're will continue to, but like these latent racist tendencies or like tendencies to see some certain difference as like an inherently bad thing when, you know, it may not be. That I've really noticed how, you know, if it just doesn't get addressed, it just stays. You know, it can just pop up and then go away. I was just buying a used car, and I'm, you know, talking to this like really old, Southern white man, mm-hmm. and he like is dropping things, you know, little kind of semi-racist little baiting things, like talking about the blacks that work at the so-and-so, like in a kind of slightly negative way, you know, and then and like does it again, and then like Asheville, isn't that where all the gay people are, you know, like, and then it's like hitting, and it's like, okay, whoa. You know, like, I can't, you know, at this point, I'm trying to maneuver here, buying a car from you. This is like, at what point do I just say, hey, dude, stop being an asshole? And, you know, at what point do I recognize, like, there may be no getting through to this dude? You know, do I really want to have a throwdown fight right now with a guy who probably, in terms of his mental rigidity, it's, like, going to be very rigid.
Yeah.
You know, I can kind of sense that already talking to him. You know, and I grew up in that environment, so I kind of know it well. You know, I don't know, and I don't know where the lines are, but it's like, man, it's real, and it's I see a lot of people on the left reacting to that, but I also, you know, I don't know what your sense is. I see that there are almost two levels of racism, you know, like, or maybe like degrees. There's like some of the stuff that I grew up with that's like really like when you see it, it's like the underbelly is just, it's really nasty, and it's like personal, and it's like it's gnarled, you know, into the person. And you know, you could imagine that person doing something awful, like if they were drunk or in the right circumstances, you know. It's like, it's that kind of dark. You know, I consider that like different from someone who has like come up in an environment that had latent racist things built into the language and into the institutions, and who has kind of not seen that around certain things. Like, that's not someone. It's a different level of processing, you know, and it's like, I think it's like we should be doing that processing, but we shouldn't be confusing or conflating those two, because one of them is actually really dangerous. You know, and it actually, in the wrong circumstances, could lead to like white nationalism or like ethno, you know, cleansing or things like that. The other one, it's like, no, people, these are people who just, you know, they're good people actually, and they don't walk around seeing things that way most of the time, but it's like latent in their language, you know. Like, that's the kind of racism I've seen in my own experience. It's like without variety. But it's frustrating being a kind of having a mixed racial identity, seeing people conflating those two, because I think it somehow does an injustice to people, you know, to us, when we don't clearly see where the real danger is, and sort of stay focused on what's really problematic, you know. Like, instead of bickering over, like, did you say the wrong words on Facebook? You know, that kind of word policing and idea, you know, like trying to get everyone to conform to it, like some sort of right way of talking. You know, it's like, no, like, there are actually people who, you know, given the right circumstances, like, they might want to kill someone because of their race. You know, that to me is like, that's the poison that's sitting at the heart of our culture. You know, that needs to be transmuted, transformed, you know, dealt with, worked with, healed.
But in order to do that, we need to be discerning about what that actually is and not conflate it, because it also strikes me that, as you're saying that, like...
Yeah, some people are going to disagree with what I'm saying, by the way, and probably right. Some people are probably right, too. But this is how I view things.
Well...
Right now.
And I think that...
Didn't expect us to go into the social stuff. It's so big right now.
It's so big, and it is what is emerging now. Is, I think, our culture world is kind of like wrestling with these nuances of identity and like appropriateness, and you know, we're being networked together in entirely new ways, and like, we are just tasting the very beginning of what the ramifications are going to be of that. And I think that
it's challenging.
We're learning. I actually do think we're learning. Like, I see us learning and responding, and actually quite quickly. I think. You know, these are ancient tendencies of mind, you know, around tribalism and other, you know.
I mean, it wasn't really until the Axial Age that we know of that, like, you know, something that was trying to offer something beyond this.
I mean, yeah. So it's like pretty new operating system to like that, you
universalism.
Know, yeah, universal brotherhood or whatever. Humanism. I mean,
yes.
And I think, yeah, it's really important. You know, I remember Angel. I really like Angel Kyoto Williams. She said, "Not everybody can be repaired." Mm. But everybody can be redeemed, right? And there's a way, everybody has the opportunity to be redeemed, perhaps. But, you know, like you said, like I like the word, like, gnarled. Like, there are things that are so deeply woven into, like, the structure of somebody's psyche that it's almost like we just have to, like, isolate and, like, put it in perspective and be like, well, we shouldn't have a cult, we should do whatever we can to make a culture that doesn't produce people like that moving forward. But, like, we shouldn't also waste our energy amplifying the dangers of that kind of stuff in light of the fact that we're at an existential bifurcation point. Mm. You know, and so choosing our battles very wisely right now, I think, is one of the most important things that we can start learning how to do.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to Ryan Olke,
you
know, mutual friend of ours, and he had a great analogy. He said, you know, he felt like Trump's superpower was to be able to do that game, you know, that where you have the three cups and you have one thing under the cup and you're kind of moving like around, you know, like a monkey could do this, right?
Yep.
So like you imagine the trained monkey doing this and that's what Trump is, kind of like a monkey doing this. He's got the superpower to like constantly be bringing your attention off of what's important.
Right.
And, you know, and just with the outrageous and the outlandish and the just dickish, you know, and it's just like one thing after another. And it's, I think it's really hard for us to stay focused on like what's actually the most outrageous, like what's the thing that we should be truly outraged about,
right?
And we can, you know, pull our force together to because it's happened many times, you know, over the last 2 years that there've been these moments where, you know, there's been a kind of response that does push things back in certain ways or like, you know, but it's been limited. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how, what is the proper way to put
it. What are you referring to as far as like these times that people have pushed back in certain ways? I'm not sure.
In the times of Trump, the post-Trumpian times.
Yeah,
there's this kind of active resistance to Trump, which, I, you know, to be honest, I don't know where I land in all of that, but it's a complicated situation.
It is, but I do think you're right, and Ryan's right, or I would agree that like there's a way in which the most important thing to notice now is the way in which our attention is trying to be controlled by certain people in power.
And fragmented.
And fragmented and like confused, right? It's almost like this kind of like big campaign of misdirection.
Yeah.
Right? Has both maybe conscious misdirectors and like you know, just people who are inadvertently participating in the misdirection of our kind of culture. If we're being charitable, you know, like maybe they don't know what they're doing, but that for each of us as individuals, then it becomes even more our responsibility to like manage our attention, you know, what we actually pay attention to, and therefore give power to, and like there's a bigger game being played than the actual content of what's being set.
Yeah, I think that's so important. It ties in with platforms, social media platforms, and you know the ways that I've been watching a video from Jaron Lanier recently. He's one of sometimes called the father of virtual reality, but he was like he's one of the key people to help develop the early VR systems. And you know, he's making an argument lately that, you know, it's like you should just get off social media. Like statistically speaking, you know, it's going to make you sadder, more depressed, like just, you know, probabilistically.
Yeah.
Some people it serves, and it serves people well, and that's why I've been on it for 10 years.
Right.
But, you know, these platforms are increasingly algorithmically manipulating us or sending us things to help sell things for certain advertisers.
Yes.
And so they're, in a sense, like they're asking us to conform our identity, or they're finding out where we get hooked, and then they're feeding us more, you know, and they're kind of like using this behavioralist tactics, basically.
Right.
And, you know, increasingly it's not just a neutral feed. It's not like Twitter used to be one, whatever comes next, it lands in your feed reverse chronologically.
Yeah.
There's no advertisements. There's no, you know, there's no algorithm that's sorting the feed or changing the feed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, to me, that's interesting, you know, to see mm-hmm. the way that the informational space is also being controlled and manipulated in particular ways that aren't with our self, you know, best interests in mind and heart.
Right.
How do we deal with that? I think that's going to be a big question for us hackers, hipsters, and hippies.
Yeah. Well, it's as you said that, it occurred to me that like the feedback loop between the systems that we create and the way they impact our like experience is becoming kind of tighter.
Mm.
And that I think it's interesting that we've, you know, Facebook is like 10 years old, and we're already having like, is that right? Is something like that.
It's close.
You know?
Yeah.
And we're already having our like come to Jesus moment with it. Like,
it's more than 10 years old, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we're getting, I mean, like, you know, like Tristan Harris has been,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about
yes.
this kind of stuff, and it does seem like what I appreciate, I think, about what you're saying, and I think Tristan Harris says the same thing, is that because these systems are, to some degree, like, organized at the behest of profit.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah.
turning whatever the raw material
yeah.
is,
they've
in this case attention, into
yeah.
profit,
yeah.
then they're going to be fucked up. There's no way
yeah.
that they can't be.
Yeah.
And so we have to get down to the level of incentives and like systems
yes.
in order to even
yes.
like think about how yeah. to resolve these
because
things.
Because those feedback loops affect our well-being.
Yeah.
And we're just they're designed to be addictive, and that's been acknowledged. And even Facebook scientists,
yeah.
you know, their own scientists,
yeah.
like acknowledge these things.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when are we going to have a real conversation about that?
Mm.
Or when are there going to be alternatives, you know, that come that are actually legitimate, like, you know, maybe Web 3.0 social networks?
Yeah.
I don't know. But those are things that vex me.
Yeah.
These days.
Yeah, and it's curious, like, how much more evidence do we need about how, like, how much evidence did it take in with cigarettes before that got regulated in a kind of
right.
more comprehensive way? Is
right.
that the same thing that's going to happen here? Like,
yeah, right,
because
really, this seems even vaster than cigarettes in a way. It's, like, more, it, like, includes more.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Well, and it implicates our children.
Right,
the children
ways.
Of our culture in a much more significant way than
it's like their future, are. You know.
Yeah, they're
the future they grew up on.
Yeah, so somebody I spoke to who was a teacher, and he's an older man, so, you know, is said that he thinks that, like, smartphones and social media are like nuclear bombs for the brain in the way that they can fracture and kind of make structure, like, incoherent, right? Mm. And, like, distract us. I don't think it's quite that bad. But I think it can be that bad, especially in a if we don't have a kind of like like an intentional relationship with these tools. Like, it does seem like the common denominator is like superficial, like dopamine based,
mm.
like social one-upsmanship or like kind of like give and take. And especially in the context of high school, it seems like very deeply screwed up.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to use it like that. We talked a little bit about that. Like,
right.
you know, it all depends on how you look at it. There is a degree of this which is system-based.
Yeah.
Like, and we should differentiate, like, we need better networks and systems that aren't organized according
yeah.
to profit.
Yes.
And, like, we're not there yet, and we're still going to probably be using these things
yeah.
to do whatever we're doing.
Yeah.
And so how do we relate to them in a way
yeah.
that doesn't...
Right.
you know, that walks that line, I
right.
think.
Right. Yeah. Because, yes, political discourse on social media is just in the dumps, like, from what I've seen.
Yeah. I never saw much political discourse.
Until?
Well.
2000.
I tend to just, I think I, like, learned to ignore it really early on in my Facebook career. You know what I bet happened is I learned to ignore it, so I didn't incentivize it in my news feed. So it then just stopped showing up, like, the people that engaged in that, because I was just like, right. So for me, I didn't have that experience.
So your feed was pruned toward
inadvertently, right? They showed me the world. Well, no, it was a kind of like,
I mean, I know that you're not politically apathetic.
Well, I think it was more of like an echo chamber of like people who kind of like, oh yeah, the world's getting better, like meditate and hopefully Bernie will win, but then he didn't, and
yeah, well, okay, whatever. I was sort of thinking of them as like algorithmic ghettos, you know, a little stronger than echo chamber.
Yeah, well, it'd only be a ghetto if there were certain spaces in which people were actually getting like a comprehensive and like, I think, like who doesn't live in the ghetto at this point, you know?
When you say ghetto, what do you mean?
Like a separate, yeah, like shittier, yeah, place, I guess. I don't know. Is that what it means?
I don't mean it as a shitty. Shitty in the sense that everyone is just talking to themselves and there's not. Uh-huh. Well. Okay, it's not that extreme. Obviously, there's people are bringing in different ideas and stuff, but it's like we're talking light nuances and shades of the same, rather than radically. You know, like on, yeah, Facebook, and suddenly your old friend from high school is like posting about Jesus, you know, mm-hmm, in your feed every day. Mm-hmm. Like we hide those things and they get pruned out, mm-hmm, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's like you said, it's hell. It's a ghetto in the sense that it's like we're all confined to this.
Right.
You know, blasé, you know, like bleak existence, you know, it's like conceptually.
Yeah.
We're just kind of, you know, all self-congratulating, you know, each other about how much we've got figured out and how smart we are.
Yeah. Although I have noticed.
I'm not saying everyone does that, but that's the extreme
case.
Well, no.
I kind of agree. But I think that there has been, again, a kind of reckoning just in the past year or two, mm, since Trump got, like, people, I noticed that people, and who knows if it's Facebook or the people that use it, you know, it's hard to disambiguate, but what I'm being shown and what's actually happening, but the people are getting more thoughtful about the way that they use social media. Mm-hmm. They're being less trivial about it. Mm-hmm. There's, like, less, like, I remember in the election, at least, during the election, like, lots of very questionable sources being shared, mm-hmm, like, especially, not to name names, but like in the Bernie community, just like, mm-hmm, very like weird kind of left, mm-hmm, sites that maybe it's a bot, maybe it's, you know, I don't
right,
know. Like,
right, right,
what
right.
is this?
Right.
I don't see that as much anymore. I feel like we're getting more sophisticated in the way that we amplify the things that come into our world and our networks of information and stuff.
I don't know if that's true in, yeah, some communities, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
It might still be like a major problem in the, I think, in some of the right-leaning communities.
Yeah, like a QAnon. Yeah.
Yeah, right. You're talking about that one.
Yeah.
That's a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I read, I think somebody said, our species is bifurcating into two groups. I don't necessarily agree with this, but I think it's a funny way of looking at it. Two groups. One is people that are just like scrolling endlessly through YouTube, right, and Instagram, are getting dopamine hits, right? And then the other group is like in their flotation tank, hooked up to an EEG monitor, like on the ketogenic diet, like, you know, studying their Anki cards to learn a new language, and, you know, half the time. And there is an element of this around, yeah, like.
Well, yeah. Netocrats, the book, the Netocrats,
right.
You know, they talk about this, Alexander Bard and Jan Söderqvist, they talk about these kind of new emerging classes, essentially, you know,
and yeah,
some of them are like playing video games in their, you know, parents' basement, mm-hmm, and not have no job or very little, or, you know, it's like their relationship to it is as a source of like digital opioid, you know.
Right.
It's kind of like a syrupy thing that you just get lost in, but there's no, it's not the kind of hyper.
Oh yeah, the consumeritariat, right? Is that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I forget, it's the equivalent of the proletariat. And it's
right,
like,
but they just consume information.
Yeah.
They don't like manage or,
yeah,
like, yeah, right. Or like,
they don't know their way around the networks, you know, they haven't had the opportunity or learned to become proficient in networkism.
Yeah, yeah.
So they just get the opioid, you know, result of the network, you know, structure, but they don't get to actually participate in a meaningful, in a makingful way with things. You know, it's not like they're steering or able to navigate some of the amazing riches of what's out there and use it for some of the purposes you're talking about, the flotation tank, the self-actualizing, you know, hipster.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, is it just a threshold experience for folks who are kind of caught in between the digital networked world and the non-digital networked world? Like, will Generation Z be, like, all networkists, or is it...
I think presumably some of them will still be consumitariats or whatever the term that Barb uses. Like, some people are just not going to, you know, be interested in that stuff, and they'll just, you know, be playing video games box office movies.
And
that seems like it's going to be a pretty high percentage.
It seems like, I mean, YouTube is crazy, man.
Yeah, and YouTube's like, mostly men, right?
Oh, I don't know.
75% or
something. I think so. Certainly a lot of young people. Young millennial men. Yeah, well, I saw that there was a, you know how they ask, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Now everybody says, I want to be a YouTube star.
Wow.
That's like the career of choice for, I mean, this is an anecdotal story, I think.
Scary. It's
yeah. Well, scary, and also I think there's there's something I'm optimistic about young people. Like, I think I heard this story, I think it was Jordan Greenhall on, was it the Future Thinkers podcast, maybe? Mm-hmm. But he talked about how he's noticed children like self-assembling worlds in Minecraft, like without any kind of like sort of overseer CEO role or plan, right? They'll just all do their thing, and all of a sudden, like, they'll build something really beautiful that none of them could have planned.
Oh, together.
Yeah, together. Uh-huh. They'll cooperate to build something.
Yeah.
And that might be that kind of sensibility of, like, cooperation and collaboration and, like, might be baked into their worldview at that kind of, like, implicit level, that these are, like, kids who have never even, you know, the school is not teaching them to do this.
Right, it's the technology itself.
Yeah, it's the medium itself.
Yeah, the software, the apps.
Yeah, and so that makes me...
Minecraft's such an interesting mirror on the emerging generation.
I've totally been addicted to Minecraft.
Have you?
No, I haven't been. I would have been if I had been.
Oh, I would too. I would too.
I would have fallen in deep.
No, for me it was like, you know, it was Diablo and...
Oh, yeah, same.
Yeah.
Magic the Gathering.
Geeky stuff, yeah.
EverQuest.
First-person shooters. For goodness, don't even get me started.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I've ever revealed this to you, but...
Oh, no.
One of the ways that I... Oh, okay. We're being hailed. One of the things that I think got me onto the path, so to speak, like meditation-wise, yeah, there's a lot of different things. But one thing I remember is grinding in World of Warcraft, and like going up. This is like my second character, and like you know, I was gonna go to this zone and kill like these beasts and harvest their treasure. To like level up, you know, and I was just—I remember I had the thought like, and then what? You know, I'm gonna level up, but like, why? You know, I'm just gonna keep leveling up. Like, there's no
right. You're gonna keep getting that dopamine hit.
Well, I just had like a moment of like metacognition about the fruitlessness of like what I was doing in World of Warcraft.
It's the samsaric logic of Warcraft.
But it was like a mini samsara loop within the bigger samsara loop. And then I lost interest in the game, like subsequently.
Yeah, that's like, interesting.
Anyways,
that's such a good analogy.
Yeah, I wonder if that's happened to other people.
I wonder if it's happening collectively. You know, that's part of how I look at Trump too. Is like as a massive disillusionment, certainly for the left, so-called. But like there are a lot of people that are just really disillusioned. You know, with our country and with our politics.
Trump as teacher.
Yeah, when are we gonna hit the bottom of the U in Trump?
I don't know.